Okay, so we're moving on to our third lecture on simulation modeling, discrete event simulation modeling, and this time we're going to look at, again, how we can interpret the output of our models. Last time we were dealing with the random elements of modeling. And so we looked at how we can generate random numbers, so uniform 0 to 1, based on these, typically how we can generate numbers that appear to be to adhere to some different distribution. Okay. We then looked at sort of how we can convince ourselves that these numbers that we have actually using some method generated, constructed, actually to some extent look random. Okay, and the main test we looked at was the chi-squared test. And this dealt with the values of the numbers and checking that the values roughly corresponded to what you expect. For instance, if you had a uniform distribution, you would, between say 0 and 1, you wouldn't expect all the values to be below a half. You'd expect them to be evenly spread. So we compared what we observed in intervals to what we would expect, and had a decision procedure as to whether that looked okay or not. We noted that random variables, or random variates, that's not the only property that they should exhibit, but that the sequencing also had some significance. And so we discussed Runge's tests to check that the sequencing of the variates also looked suitably random. So again, if you if all of your variates were if your numbers were continuously increasing, you would be suspicious of that sort of a sequence. Okay, and the Runge's test would catch that sort of, and the various Runge's tests would indicate that that's a very unlikely sequence to have. Finally, we considered hypothesis testing, which is, again, just a way of sort of formalizing the discussion of exactly what we're testing. Okay, so we now have the tools to build a model and generate sequences for the model, so generate traces for the model. And the question is, how can we examine these traces to determine whether or to ask questions about our model? Okay, and of course the questions we want are statistical in nature. They tend to have to do with averages, maybe variances or distributions. Okay, so that's what we're going to look at today, the output analysis for simulations. The references are the same as previous. Okay, so I believe, as we've noted before, output analysis either predicts the performance for a single system or possibly compares the performance of two or more alternative systems. We're going to look at this first issue of predicting the performance for a single system. Okay. If we have non-determinism, statistical components to our system, then any output that we observe is one among an infinite number of possible outputs. Okay. And so the question is, what can we infer from this single output? And the answer is maybe not much, since, again, it's one among an infinite number of alternatives. But we'll see if we run a number, if we run some number of trials, so get more than one trace, then we will be able to say something about some quantities within the system. Okay. And so what we say is that we can estimate system parameters, such as mean and standard deviation, probability distributions, and percentiles. So, again, it's just probabilistic quantities. But still, it's impressive that by observing the behavior a finite number of times, then you can get a pretty good idea of what's going on in the system. Okay. So, again, the first thing we're going to have to do is somehow collect our observations in a way that's sort of useful for us. Okay. And so we can think about our simulation variables and categorize our simulation variables. And they can be either exogenous or endogenous. Exogenous are the input variables, so they're independent of other variables during the course of the simulation run, so they're the input to the system, or potentially something sort of internal to the system, but not influenced by the system behavior. Okay, so we're going to have the running example of a queue, and for a queue, we'd think of the inter-arrival times and the service times as being exogenous. They aren't dependent on the state of the system. Endogenous variables are affected by other variables in the course of the simulation run. And so these are internal, potentially, or output variables. And generally, these are the ones that we wish to measure to gain information about the system. So, as an example, for a queue, we have mean waiting times, or mean number of jobs in the queue. And those are things, again, that we can observe in the system and give us information about the system and that allow us to draw conclusions about the system. Okay. So we're constructing our exogenous variables. We have to then collect or observe our endogenous variables or data. Okay. So, as we said before, the trace ultimately tells us everything we need to know about this, or everything we can know about the system. And so, one way of collecting our endogenous data is to just analyze the trace. And if you do that, you can just export your data to a file for later analysis. You can also build more logic into your simulation model to allow you to track various quantities of interest. Okay, so you can add additional data structures within your simulation model to store the relevant data. So you could have something like linked lists that would hold durations of interest, or running counts that determine the amount of time you're spending in specific states, etc. And so as an example, if we think about waiting times, if we examine the trace, well, every arrival-departure pair has has timestamps, and therefore you can determine the waiting time by the timestamp between the difference between the departure and arrival timestamps, or you can construct running tallies of time between arrivals and departures, and so just keep counting, sort of counting for each departure. Okay, so if we look at our simple queue, and we have a distribution of arrival and service processes, first in, first out discipline, and we're running the simulation then for a fixed period of time over which there's some number n of arrivals. That's going to give you a single sample of system behavior, and you have two event types of events. You have arrival and departure events. Okay, and again, the inter-arrival time and the service times are exogenous variables, so they're determined by the event logic. Beyond that, there's the things that we want to sort of examine within the system. So, for instance, the waiting time. And so, as we see, the waiting time is just going to be the difference between arrivals and departures. And the question that we could ask is, well, how are we, so we can see what it is sort of graphically, but how do we measure that? In particular, again, what we're sort of a specific waiting time for one arrival isn't that enlightening, but we might ask, well, what's the average waiting time in the system? Okay. And so that average waiting time, we just take a sample average. We can, if there are I completed, or if there are N completed jobs, then the sample average is just, averaging the waiting time for each of the jobs. Okay. Naturally, to do that, you have to extract your waiting time. And so you need to keep a running count of departures, or, again, you can tally this up on the fly. And it's relatively straightforward. Okay. Another question we might ask is about the average queue length. Going forward, not backwards. And so, again, we can see that at any given point of time, your queue, you have a certain number of jobs waiting in the queue. And so, to determine what your average queue length is, you can take a time average. So 1 over our total time period, capital T, and then whatever the area under that curve is. So integrate to find the area under that curve. Okay, so your average queue length is 1 over T, integral from 0 to T, and T dt. Now, that's fine, except we didn't generate nt, so we need to see how can we extract that information from our simulation trace. And one thing you can do is to observe that the number in the queue only changes upon either arrival or departure, and it either increases by 1 or decreases by 1. So we can track the time between arrivals and departures. Giving us a duration for being in any specific state at any given time. And then for any state, we could keep a running tally of how much time we spend in that state. Okay, so if we go back to our example here, we would start in state 0, we would be in state 1 for a period of time. You could count that. Then you would be in state 0, then state 1, so one person waiting for a period of time, then two people, then you'd go to state 2, two people waiting, then state 3, back to 2, back to 1. And again, you can just count up the amount of time. Since you have all those time stamps, you can count up the number of times you're spending in any given state. Okay, so again, we can do this by examining the traces, and the trace gives you your waiting time information in quite a straightforward fashion, but again, the queue length is sort of not, the queue length has to do more with the states than with the events. And so what you would essentially, if all you had was a trace, you would have to be reconstructing the states from the trace information. Okay, so you can see that your sequence of arrivals and departures is leaving you in various states for various time durations, and again, if all you have is the trace, you're going to have to reconstruct that information from the trace. Now, there's no problem doing that, but but you could also, again, try and collect that information on the fly. Okay. So, again, if you just look at the trace, you can determine what state you're in any given period of time, and then count up how long you spend in said state. Your other option, again, is to, you would have state transitions in the event logic already, so you can associate the duration of time to those durations, tally them on the fly. So again, your event logic tells you you're going from state to state, and count up the amount of time you spend in any given state based on your event logic, and then you'll have that information at the end of your simulation. Okay. So you need to think about the types of questions you're asking, and again, if you you can build in sort of the appropriate data gathering tools into your model, instead of sort of having to essentially rerun at least some portion of the simulation after the fact. Okay, so again, you can store your variables in a number of ways. First of all, you can export your traces to a file, or again, you can build in data structures within your simulation. So, you can have arrays or linked lists, which allow you to store information as you go along on the fly. Again, arrays are a finite length, so yeah, you'll need to be ensure that you aren't going to exceed the length. For instance, if you are trying to measure your duration, find your average queue length and measure your duration in each state, then you could have potentially any number of states. So you could have any number of customers waiting, and therefore you probably want to use something like a linked list to keep that information. You may also be able to keep running averages or running tallies of information. Okay, so for instance, waiting time, it's pairs of arrivals and departures, and if it's first come, first served, then you can measure each individual waiting time as you go, sum them all up, and take a running average. So this would be the quickest way to do things, but if you sort of changed your mind at all about what you wanted to measure, obviously you may have to rerun the simulation if you need to gather other pieces of information. Okay, so we're going to spend most of the time talking about average values, but there are other questions of interest, and so typically we also sometimes ask about the distribution of data. So another quantity of interest is the percentile value, and so the percentile value is the value achieved by some person with the sort of maximum value achieved by some percentage of the population or observations. So for our queue, we could ask something on the order of what's the maximum waiting time experienced by 95% of our arrivals. And so to answer that for any observation, roughly you're going to have to track the waiting time of all the arrivals, and then order them. So, given enough observations, we can then pick the 95th one, 95th percent one. So if you have 100 observations, then you'd pick the 95th one. If you had 200 observations, you'd pick the 190th one. Okay. So, returning to our sort of simple observations. So we've now, for instance, observed or calculated our average waiting time for a single observation, or maybe our average queue length or percentile value. We've observed these things, but we've observed them for one single observation. And so the question becomes, does this tell us anything about sort of the system as a whole? And you would sort of have a suspicion that not, because this is one example amongst many you could have chosen, so it was dependent on the initial conditions. And also, the individual samples are not independent of each other. So that's an example with waiting time. If your WI is high, so if the ith waiting time was high, then you probably have a fairly congested system, and the I plus first waiting time will also be high. Okay, so we're not necessarily so in some way our calculations, they're giving us a single point of observation, but we can't really generalize to sort of the system as a whole. Okay. So what we're going to do is we're going to take multiple observations. And what we'd like to do is say, calculating the average waiting time for one run isn't really going to be that enlightening, but we're going to calculate the average waiting time for 50 runs. And what we're going to ask is, well, if we have 50 observations, or 20, or 10, or whatever, if you have more than one observation, can we say that these are somehow representative, are somehow sort of indicative of the system averages, so the true system parameters. Okay. Now we're still only having observations, so we're never going to get exactly to the value of our system parameter, but what we'd like to say is that we are going to fall close to the value of our system parameter. Again, these things are probabilistic, so we can't say that we hit the exact value, but we'd like to be able to say that we're within plus or minus something of that exact value. Okay, so the key concept that we're going to explore now is that of what's called a confidence interval. And that's going to give us an estimate of how close, or some idea of how close our estimate is to the actual system parameter. So it's sort of analogous to the critical levels that we were using on the chi-square test. Okay. So before we uh, look at multiple runs, we'll make one more observation, and that's that typically your system behavior for simulation or for real life is going to divide itself up into two periods. We have an initial or transient phase. So if you start with your Q equals zero, because there's just nobody, you know, you haven't started, you haven't sent people in yet, then for a while it's sort of growing and growing. As time goes on, it tends to center, the Q length, for instance, tends to center around an average, okay? And so the transient phase is before you've sort of populated your system and when it's sort of not adhering to that average. Then we have a steady state phase where the statistical behavior is no longer dependent on the initial conditions. Okay. And the questions that we're looking at are concerned with the steady state of the system. So if the system is up and running, has been running for quite a while, then we're asking questions about that. When we look at queuing, we'll see again if the system is stable, then it's then values will cycle around averages. Okay. So when both phases are interesting, but the one that we're concentrating on is the steady state phase. And so when we're measuring our system values, then we want to do that for the steady state phase of the system. So how do we decide that we're in steady state? And, well, we can just keep running with longer and longer runs and keep compiling our statistics for each length of run and then choose, based on those observations, you can choose a length so that your statistics are not varying significantly for longer and longer runs. Okay. This can be done on the fly, so you can compute, if you're computing your values on the fly, then we can assume it's steady state when the values stop changing significantly. So what do we do about the transient data? Well, if we're looking for our steady state behavior, then we want to ignore it or discount it. And we can either do that by explicitly dropping the data, so we've decided that some time period T marks the end of our transient phase, so we just ignore everything, collect and only collect data after T. Or if you run the simulation for long enough, that T represents only a small fraction of the total simulation time. Therefore, any data collected there would have a small weighting in the overall calculation. Then you can just leave the data in, and it will be in, and again, just because you have so much of the steady state data, the transient data will not significantly affect the outcome. Okay, so the parameters that we're estimating are steady state parameters. And again, the ones that we're concentrating on are mean, variance, and percentiles. And we'll start by and spend most of the discussion talking about means, so averages, and then we'll see, then we can see that sort of similar techniques apply to variances and percentiles. So overall, our system will have an actual value for the parameter. Okay, so we're just going to call our system parameter theta. So the average Q length, as an example, if you consider the infinites, all the infinite possibilities, there's one average value. The problem is we don't know what it is. Okay. We're going to use a number of independent simulation experiments to produce an estimator for this parameter, which we'll call theta hat. Okay. And again, we can think of, if we ran our simulation 50 times, we would get 50 different values, 50 different average Q lengths for each run. And from that, from those 50 observations, we want to come up with some estimator for theta. And you could think the easiest thing to do, again, would be to take a sample average. So if you have 50 different values for each of your runs, then 1 over 50. So just take the straight average of that. Okay, and the key thing that we're getting by taking 50 separate runs is independence of these observations. Okay, and we'll see that that's critical for determining our confidence interval. Okay. So, what should our estimators be? And again, the obvious thing to do is just to take a sample average. Okay. So we can let x1 through xn be our observed values. And these are themselves, they're random variables, and they will have some overall mean and variance. Okay, so, and we assume that if our runs are independent, then they're independent. Identically distributed with the same mean and variance. Okay, so as an example, we can think of our average waiting times, and xi would be the average, or wi would be the average waiting time for the ith run for our simulation. Okay. So, to estimate the average or mean, we just take the sample average, and similarly, we can propose to take the sample average for the variance. So, the question is, how good are these estimates. And so we'll have two criteria. We will be building our confidence intervals. But we would expect, first of all, that the expectation of the estimators should be close to the actual system parameter. So you would hope that on average you're close to the system parameter, and the measure of how close you are is what's called bias. And so bias is just the difference between the expectation of your estimator and the actual fixed parameter. Okay. So what that's saying is that you know that your estimate is going to vary. It's not going to give you your parameter exactly, but if you observe your estimate, or if you sort of consider all possible values for your estimate, you'd expect at least the expectation to be equal to the parameter. Okay. And so we would like to say that is true for our estimators, that we have unbiased estimators. Okay. So what we'll show is that our sample average of means is unbiased, but our sample estimator for variance is biased, but if instead of dividing by 1 over n, you divide by 1 over n minus 1, you produce an unbiased estimator for variance as well. Okay, so to see that our sample mean estimator is unbiased, we just take the expectation, and that's the expectation 1 over n, summation I equals 1 to n xi, and since it's a finite sum, you can move the expectation in, but our xi, our iid, with an expectation of the of mu, and therefore the expectation of our sample estimator is mu. Okay, so that's unbiased. We can try to do that again for our variance. And so we just plug in our estimate. We're trying to take the expectation of our estimate. And so we can see things, we subtract xi and x bar by mu, and then expand out our terms. And so we get xi minus mu squared minus 2 xi minus mu x bar minus mu plus x bar minus mu squared. Then we can try and we look at the estimate for each of these. The expectation for each of these, and we see that for the second term, the expectation of xi minus mu gives us the sort of this, well, the summation one over n of that, yeah, gives us expectation of x bar minus mu squared, and then we that's minus 2 and then plus 1, so we get minus expectation of x bar minus mu squared. And then for our first term, we see that we have expectation of 1 over n sum xi minus mu squared. But that will give our variance. So each, if you pull the expectation inside, each time you're getting that's the variance, sigma squared. So, and you do it n times, and 1 over n, and you get sigma squared minus expectation of x bar minus mu squared. And so that's going to be less than sigma squared, so we have a biased term. Okay. So, as we said, if we look at 1 over n minus 1, summation xi minus x bar squared, then we actually get an unbiased estimate. And so to do that, we have to keep modifying our terms, so pull the n minus 1 over to the other side for the moment, and look at the expectation of, if we expand out, the square. Okay, so you're going to get n times expectation of xi squared, and that's going to, again, that's the same for all of the xi, and then minus 2 expectation of x bar summation xi squared plus n expectation of x bar squared. And so the expectation of xi squared is given by x bar. So you have n x bar, and that would give you, pulling out the n, minus 2 expectation of x bar squared plus n, minus 2n expectation of x bar squared plus n expectation of x bar squared. And so that gives you n expectation of xi squared minus n expectation of x bar squared. Okay. And so we can just plug in our definition of variance. So expectation of x squared is the variance, variance plus the mean squared. Okay. And so we pull out the, and we pull the n over to the other side now, and pull out our mean and right variance in terms of sigma and, or right, excuse me, our expectation of xi squared in terms of sigma and mu. So the question then becomes, what's sigma bar squared and mu bar? And we, again, resort to the central limit theorem to determine that. And, again, our x bar if we recall, is our sample mean. So it's 1 over n sum of, so it's an averaged value over a bunch of observations. And so now if we sum enough things, they're all IID. If we sum enough of them, then the distribution of that random variable begins to look normal, again with the mean of mu and the variance is sigma squared over n. Okay. So we can plug in those values for sigma bar squared and mu bar, and so sigma bar squared is sigma squared over n, mu bar is just mu, so yeah, mu bar squared is mu squared. Okay, and you get n minus 1 over n, expected value of s squared is that quantity, and if you work that out, you can show that that's actually equal to sigma squared. Okay, so that gives us an unbiased estimator for sigma squared. Okay, so we now have our two estimators. So we have an estimator for an average and an estimator for variance. And so the question then becomes, how do we reason about these averages now? Okay, for these estimates now. Okay, and we're going to again look initially at the means. Sort of estimating averages to see this. Okay, so again, what we're going to do is define what's called a confidence interval. And so we start by defining a confidence level, and this will be some high number, high percentage, like 95%. And then we define a confidence interval, and that confidence interval is going to be centered around our parameter theta, and indicates that our estimate theta hat will be in this interval 95% of the time. Okay, so the problem with that is that we don't actually know theta. But we can turn that around and say that we can define the interval around, the same interval would apply around theta hat. And if the interval of the same width, then your actual system parameter will be in that interval 90% of the time, 95% of the time. Okay, so when we're initially working things out, again, it's the interval would be around our actual system parameter, but since we don't know that, we can define the interval around our estimator and say, again, that the actual system parameter would be in that interval, whatever your confidence level is, percent of the time. Okay. So, if your interval is relatively small, then, and your confidence level is relatively high, then you're reasonably comfortable, you've got a good degree of comfort that the value you've estimated is actually close to the system parameter. Okay. So how do we do this again? We're using the central limit theorem to define these intervals. Okay. And now this is the third time we've reproduced the central limit theorem. So again, if we take if we average a bunch of random variables, then if you average enough of them, and it's important they are independent and identically distributed, if you average enough of them, then the distribution of that average starts looking normal, with a mean, as you would expect, and a variance sigma squared over n. Okay. So now what we're concerned with is the shape of that distribution around the mean. Okay. So what we can see with that shape is that we're getting the bell curve shape, for one thing, and the other thing we see is that that curve is sort of getting tighter and tighter around our mean the more samples we take. So again, you start with, in our example here, we start with 1 and we keep going up by a factor of 2. And you see, again, you start seeing the bell curve shape appearing, and also the more samples you have, the tighter the curve is around the average. Okay. So our rule of thumb is going to be that if we have 30 samples, the distribution of the estimator is going to look normal. Okay. So how does this help us with our confidence interval? Well, for normal distributions, it's common practice to express what percentage of the population falls within some distance around the mean, and typically the distance is expressed as a multiple of a standard deviation. Okay, so again, we see that here we've got our mean, and then a certain percentage is going to fall within one standard deviation of the mean, so that's 68.2% will be within one standard deviation of the mean. Within 2, you get, 47.7, so roughly 95% fall within 2 standard deviations of the mean, etc. Okay. So, we can that would give us what percentage of the population lies around the mean, but we can sort of turn that around and say, well, if we want to capture a certain percentage of the population, what distance from the mean will do that for us? Okay. And that's what we do with our confidence intervals and confidence levels. Okay, so for our confidence level, say 95%, we ask, again, as a multiple of our standard deviation, how many standard deviations what multiple do we need around the mean? And that then gives us our confidence interval. Okay. So, again, if I said roughly 95% was roughly two standard deviations, well, you know, there's an exact value for that as well, and we can use that to define our confidence level. Okay. There's no direct calculation of this value of the distribution, but tables exist giving you these values. Okay, and so the information we have will be in tabular form. So let's start with 95%. So we want to ask the question, what multiple of the standard deviation does 95% of the population fall within? And so if we look at our table, the table is only capturing half the curve, so it's capturing one half of the curve. So if we want 95%, that's 47.5%. And again, as a fraction, that's 0.475. Okay, so we want 0.475 or 47.5% between the mean and one side of the standard deviations. And so what multiple gives us that? And again, from the table, you read the top, the first decimal point, it gives you 1.9 along the rows, and then looking at the columns, you get 0.06, so 1.96 standard deviations capture 95% of the population. And so that's the table gives you from the mean to the mean plus 1.96 sigma. Obviously, the interval goes on both sides, so you get the mean plus or minus 1.96 sigma. Okay. So, moving this back to our parameter estimation problem, and specifically the estimation of a mean, we've said that our samples taken from each different trace are IID with a mean of the system mean and a variance of the system variance. Okay. We produced our estimator by taking the sample average of all our observations. So, again, we can apply apply our theorem to that and assume that it's that this has a normal distribution. Okay. So, we don't actually know sigma, but we have an estimator for sigma, and so we can use that to construct our confidence interval around our observed estimate of mean. Okay, so again, we just take our unbiased sample estimator for our variance. And we'll call that S squared. And so, as in the example, if we want a confidence level of 95%, we construct our confidence interval around our mean estimator, and so it's x bar plus or minus 1.96 for the 95%, and then our estimate of standard deviation S. And again, S squared over N is our variance, so the square of that is S over square root of N. Okay. So again, the bit more observations we take, the tighter that confidence interval will be around the mean, and the more accurate our estimate. Okay, so that's probably the key concept for this lecture is just how we are able to say something about our system parameter from a finite number of observations. Everything else is just sort of variations on that theme. Okay. So our first variation returning to our same estimator, but asking the question, what happens if our sample size is not large? And the answer is that we have what's called the student's T distribution. And sort of one interesting bit of local trivia is that the man who proposed the student's T distribution is actually a Dubliner. Was working for Guinness Brewery, and the reason that it's called Student's Tea and not according to his name is that it was being used by Guinness as a quality assurance method to feed into quality assurance, and so it was considered a trade secret. And therefore, he was not able to publish it under his own name. But he did publish it sort of anonymously as a student. Okay. So the student's T distribution gives us, again, an estimate of the distribution for our sample mean, but now it's not normal. The distribution now is dependent on how many samples you have, which is, again, captured as degrees of freedom. Okay, so the degrees of freedom is the number of samples minus one, just as we saw last time for the chi-squared test. Okay, and so the methodology is the same. We want to express a confidence interval as some multiple of the standard deviation centered around our mean estimate. But now we obtain our values from the student's T distribution. Okay, so if we, and again, these distributions are available in tabular form. They're not, you can't directly calculate them or easily calculate them. So if we look at an example, we can have, we might have 11 samples, and we wish to have the same confidence level of 95%. Now, it's what this table is giving us is, again, half of the distribution, and it's giving you what lies outside of that, outside of the of the center. Okay, so what lies in the tail. Okay, so we had 5%, and so half of that is 2.5%, so we need to look at 0.025 for our probability. So that's the probability of lying in these, in this tail. And then it's based on degrees of freedom, so we have 10 degrees of freedom, 10 degrees of freedom, and 10 degrees of freedom, 0.025 gives us 2.228. Okay. From there, we do exactly the same thing. It's a function of standard deviations away from that. Okay. So, in general, what this will do is it will give you a larger confidence interval, so these so the multipliers will be larger than they would be for the normal distribution. What we can see is that as the numbers increase, we converge to the student's T distribution actually converges to the normal distribution. But again, the rule of thumb that we're going to use is that if we have 30 or greater samples, we'll use the normal distribution to construct our confidence interval. If we have less, then we will use the student's T distribution. Okay, so again, this concept of confidence intervals is the key concept for this lecture. So we've seen that we can estimate, in particular, system averages, and we can do it in a way that's we're likely to be close to the actual system value. And indeed, we can use our confidence intervals to quantify what that means. So again, a certain percentage of time will actual value will lie within the confidence interval then. Okay, so we'll briefly break here, and then we'll see that we can look at other, we can estimate other system parameters in and construct confidence intervals in essentially the same fashion. So we'll take up with that, and then we'll also look at the idea of runs and how we actually produce our runs. Okay, so we'll look at that in the second part of this lecture.